Stella Williams, Reel 20.
Are we starting again?
Yes, you were finishing off this piece about Africa and how interesting it was, you know, that the missionaries had started off by picking out the intelligent tribes and how this in turn, and with time, created jealousy and tension.
Yes, it did. Yes. There's no doubt about that, it has. But you see, even it still goes on, because I was in Nigeria a couple of years ago. I'll go back to the Nigerian war in due course, because I was mixed up in that. But it was the Igbos, who were the intelligent lot, who had taken over the government, or taken over a lot of the government, and a lot of the money in the country, and the other tribes had taken a dim view, and that was how that was the sort of war. Well, it was very interesting when I was back there 2 years ago that the Igbos are creeping back into government power. And I was surprised at when I was, because I met several of the ministers while I was there, and I was surprised to find that they were Igbos, because they have got the brains. And the missionaries didn't usually make a mistake on that, or they'd created the tension, but they didn't make a mistake in what they picked out usually. And it was interesting that the Igbos are coming back. Of course, Nkrumah had been missionary trained. I'm not sure whether they'd actually sent him away or whether they'd just trained him locally, but he certainly had a missionary educational background. Not that it made him any kinder, I think, towards the towards the Christian facilities. But Ghana. You see, Ghana had a secondary school back in the 1860s or something, a secondary school for Africans. I mean, at a time when that sort of thing wasn't anywhere. So, I mean, Ghana did have a really good leading start in the race for independence and supremacy and one thing and another in Africa. They did have a very good start on that.
It was very interesting when you were talking about Nkrumah and his vision and these various sort of projects which you looked at very positively, because he was so criticised in the West for these, wasn't he? I remember myself, the dam, and the sort of criticism about a grandiose scheme that this was. But from what you're saying,
Viola, thought he was as mad as Hitler with all he was doing. But he was doing it right, and it's still working. And I think, certainly, in a lot of parts of Africa, the sort of opinion of it has changed very considerably. That he is beginning to be seen as somebody who knew what he was doing. You see that the chap in Tanzania. What was his name? I forget his name. He also
Nyerere, wasn't it? Julius Nyerere.
Yes. He had vision, but he hadn't got enough finance behind him to deal with it. But he did have. You see, he had vision. He said everybody in Tanzania had got to learn Swahili, no matter what tribe they belonged to. They got to learn Swahili, so that everybody in Tanzania can talk to each other. They still can't in Ghana. There are still problems in Ghana. I mean, even in the Y, sometimes we had problems. Even on the committee, sometimes we had problems because we had two or three different tribes. But that was another bit of African vision that came up.
This coup against Nkrumah. Was there any sort of view? You were obviously mixing with a lot of the top people. Was there any sort of, did you know how it came about, and was there outside help, i.e. America?
No, I don't think America was mixed up in that one. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to stick my neck out, but I don't think America was mixed up in that. I don't think anybody was mixed up in that except the Ghanaians themselves. The Nkrumah had imported all these Russians, as Advani says, and they were resented. But I think that it wasn't an outside engineer one, I don't think. What I did get, of course, in the Y was that several of our Y ladies, their husbands had spoken out against Nkrumah and were in jail. We did have several who were so that, I mean, we did get a feeling of that there was a lot of feeling against Nkrumah, but we certainly hadn't realised to what an extent it had gone into the army.
And you had no clue when you were dancing with your officers?
Yes. We had a lovely party, and we drove home. I mean, there was the Burma camp was quite some way, and I have a feeling that I drove up there on my own. And there was no problem. I mean, it was all very sort of, it was terribly civilized.
You had something to say on Ghana as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Kwame Nkrumah was wooing China or whether China was wooing Kwame Nkrumah, but they sent a delegation over to discuss trade and various things. And in the Y, our YWCA in China had closed down when China went red. And so we'd had nothing from China for a long time. And this delegation arrived in Ghana, and in the office one day, the telephone bell rang, and this was Margaret Marte, spitting blood, more or less. And she said, "I've got three Chinese women here, and they want to see the YWCA." And so, with great excitement, we said, "Oh, well, do come to tea. We'll lay on tea, which is the best day." And so we laid on tea, and Margaret Marty came in with a frown that would have frozen Zeus, I think. And the three Chinese came in. One of them spoke some English. The other two didn't speak any English. And they sat there very peacefully, and they drank their tea and all that. And then quite suddenly, the one that spoke English stood up, and she said, "I bring you greetings from the YWCA of China," and sat down. And that was the first we'd had out of China for about 20 years. The moment they'd gone, I rang up Geneva, and I told my boss in Geneva, I said, "We've heard from China." And they'd finished their tea and they departed, and that was the end of that.
So did this mean that it had gone on all that time in China?
We had somebody called Cora Ding, who had not exactly been keeping the Y going, but when China opened up again, she just came straight out and brought it all up again. We've now got a very good Y in China again, but that was the first that we've had out of China for a long time, and I was so excited. And they were so funny. Margaret, they didn't want to say anything else. I don't think they dared say anything else. I don't think the woman who spoke English first dared say anything else. But it was just, "I bring you greetings." So, but otherwise, I finished in Ghana, and I don't think I even came home. I think I went straight over to Kenya because the Ministry of Overseas Development had landed me something over there in Kenya, and that must have been in 60. I don't know, it must have been 60 somewhere. But I can't remember the actual dates of that. But I think this
would have been after Kenyatta.
66, I think it was. Mm. And I was there, responsible for the all the women's organisations in Kenya. I'd been seconded to the Ministry of Social Services or something. And I was supposed to sort of keep an eye on them and get them going. And I was working through the National Council of Women. And we had... I'd worked almost entirely with Margaret Kenyatta because she was my chairman. And
would she have been related to the leader?
Yeah. And Margaret was wonderful. I adored Margaret. She was as crooked as a corkscrew, and but she, as far as I was concerned, she was a wonderful chairman, and we got on very well. Kenya at that time was really beginning to get itself straight again. To some extent, the Mau Mau was beginning to drift back into people in memory of it. The Minister of Agriculture was white at that time, so I mean it was working, and the Minister of Finance was the one of the finest men, I think, that I've met. He was a wonderful bloke. He came from a small tribe. He ran his ministry. He didn't care what he had in it, whether it's black, white, brown, yellow, whatever it was, whatever age, whatever shape, size. If they could do the job he wanted done, he had them in his ministry. If they couldn't, they were out. And because he did not fill his ministry with his own tribe murdered him. And I've always felt that if Tom had... If when Nkrumah died... And why then Kenyatta died? If Tom had been around, I think Tom would have been a world statesman. Yeah. And so was Kenyatta. Kenyatta was definitely. I mean, people did. All right, his Mau Mau experience and all that was bad. But when he came to power, he was a world statesman. And we haven't had very many since. For quite a long time, and he was one. And I'm quite certain if Tom had Tom and Boyer had gone on, he would have come right to the top. His missus has also been a very powerful woman in Kenya. Pamela, she was on my committee. She was one of my committee members, and she's still very strong. But. We didn't. It was on the whole. It was comparatively a peaceful period. There wasn't much. There wasn't a great deal of trouble of any description. You could move about without any difficulty. You could move in Nairobi. You could drive out anywhere. The only discordant note, almost the only discordant note I had the whole time I was there, because we had Muslim organisations. We had Buddhist, Catholic, Anglican, local, you name it, we had the lot. And we also had WISO, the Jewish Women's Organization, and they came under my umbrella. And one of them, I got on very well with, we got on extremely well. But I was talking, right? They'd asked me to go and speak to them about something or other, to the widow group. And I was speaking when about 3 days after the 1966 bust up in Jordan and Israel. And they read out at that meeting a list of the atrocities that the Arabs were performing on the Israelis. I mean, this was 3 days after the thing had started. And by the end of the afternoon, they'd collected over £3,000 for the Israeli army. And I was the guest speaker that day, so I couldn't say anything about anything. And I just bubbled with wrath inside. But because they must have had all that printed before the war started, before that 6 day war started. It must have all been ready, all printed, all ready to go out. And but otherwise, Kenya was comparatively peaceful.
You were saying about the Mau Mau, that had faded, was that, beginning to that, fade.
Yes, the one bit of that did hang over, and this is something, again, which I found in a lot of other places, is that Kenyatta, when he was fighting the Mau Mau War, he had with him, of course, a gathering of Kenyans who were supporting him, and who were doing their stuff by the Mau Mau. And then, as usual, when Kenyatta took over, he was expected to recompense those who had worked very hard with him. And one of them, shall I name a name? Dr. Kiano. He had been a staunch supporter of Kenyatta and expected recompense. And Kenyatta, while I was there, Kenyatta tried him in every single ministry that he could. And he made a complete balls up of each ministry they did to. And finally, Kenyatta had to say, I'm sorry, and gave him an honorary professorship of some university or something like that. But it was a very good example of the way that you can be a first-class freedom fighter, but you are not an administrator. And that was that was a very, very good example of that. He was a nice young man, but he just had no idea of administration. His wife was quite brilliant. I had hoped to see her when I was there this spring, but she was away. Jane was a very, very clever woman. And one of the problems, this isn't exactly war, but it showed the sort of attitude, was that I also have a lot to do with the Associated Countrymen in the World. And for Africa, we always had three African representatives on the world, executives of that, on the world board, whatever they call themselves. And always we had one from East Africa, one from West Africa, and one from South Africa. And the South African was always a white South Africa. And I took a very, very dim view of that when I was there. And so I had a certain amount of influence, I suppose. And I managed to get a black in as the South African representative on the executive. And she didn't like it. She didn't like Catherine, somebody like that, and she didn't like it, but we then got Jane on, and Jane was quite brilliant as the Associated Country in the World Vice President, one of the Vice Presidents of Africa. She was very good, and she's still very good. She's a clever woman. Mm-hmm. But that otherwise, Kenya was, it was very interesting. I enjoyed it. One thing. Now this might be relevant. I've never been a girl guide, but one of my best friends is a Swede, and she was the boss of the Girl Guides, the World Girl Guides in London, and she wanted to have a training course for Girl Guide leaders in Africa. And because she knew me, she said, could I organise it in Nairobi? And of course, I got Girl Guides were part of my racket anyway, so I mean, that was all part of the thing. So I ran I didn't run it, but I got the course all ready for her, and she stayed with me and operated for me. But we had leaders from all, they were all black, I think, because I think they were all black. And they came from all the countries in Africa where there was a Girl Guide movement, and it's quite an extensive movement. But the Congo woman didn't turn up. And so we started the meeting without her. And she rolled in 2 days later, and we said, hello, what happened to you? Where did you go? She had a lot of difficulty getting it. Congo was in the middle of the war, the Dam War at the time. And she said she had a lot of difficulty getting out. And when we were all talking about what we were doing in the Girl Guides and so on, and she said that she owed the Girl Guides the most tremendous debt because her village had been wiped out in their war. She lost all her parents, and she at that time must have been, she must have been somewhere about 15, I suppose, at the time. And she said, I ran away into the bush, and because I was a Girl Guide, I could hide my tracks, I could feed myself, I could look after myself. And she said, I was in the bush for 3 months, and it's because I was a Girl Guide that I was able to do it. It's a lovely story, and it's a true one. And it made our meeting, that girl from the Congo. The others have all been fairly, the others have been fairly straightforward. I don't think they had very much. By that time, we'd got Girl Guides going again in Ghana anyway, because with Nkrumah going, we got the Girl Guides. So we had them from almost everywhere. But that was a good story, that one. But otherwise, Kenya was comparatively calm. And then the British Ministry of Education, to whom I was affiliated for pension purposes, and informed me in no uncertain terms that I had outstayed my 5 years overseas, and I was due for a session in the UK. Because apparently, I don't know why, but it's still their policy, but if you were working overseas attached to the Ministry of Education, they wanted you back after about 5 years to get up to date with what was going on and so on. It was very sensible. It was intensely irritating because it caught me out twice. But it was a good thing. And I came back to the UK.
Yes, before you go on from there, you know, a little more about Kenya. Would this have been the time with the border dispute with Uganda, Idi Amin, in Kenya?
No,
was there any of that?
No, that was before then.
Yes, I see.
Yeah, this was before Idi Amin.
Yes.
I went over to Uganda several times while I was in Kenya.
Did you? Yes. What was it like then, Uganda?
Well, this would have been pre-Idi... Why was all right, because Mrs. Aboki was one of our members, so I mean, we had no problems. The Asians were operating all the shops, or most of the shops. Obote, I think he was another one who probably was able to get there. And once he got there, he was a shopping administrator, but it was ticking over.
In Kenya, you know, this 1960...
63, 66.
Yeah. Was there any corruption?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, everybody's always corrupted. But you more or less have to take it and just try it. It didn't affect me, I don't think, in any way at all. But I knew that the people that I was working with, quite a lot of them were. Not all of them. Phoebe Ascio, who was the head of the Women's Police, I think was as straight a woman as you'd find anywhere. Julio Giambo, who was a minister's wife, she was quite... One thing that did happen while I was in Kenya, which was quite interesting, was that Kenyatta wanted to have some women in his parliament. And he wanted to nominate 4 women to come into his parliament. I don't think they would have been particularly political appointments. I think he was going out for quality rather than politics. And he wanted 4 women. And to their undying credit, those 4 women said no, they were not coming in as nominations, because if they did, they'd have no power at all. They said, when we get into Parliament, we are going into Parliament under our own steam. And I've always admired them for that, because it was quite an honour to be asked. And Julio Giambo was one of them. She was on one of my committees. And when she put up for Parliament, she knocked the minister out. So we were terribly proud of Julia. She stayed on as minister. I'm not sure she was in education. She was minister of something or other for quite a long time, anyway. And now, of course, they do get elected properly. There was a woman stood against Arap Moy in the last elections. I wrote her a good luck letter because I thought she needed all the good luck. She didn't get in, of course, and that was corruption. There was no doubt about that. But then the last elections that they had over there have been absolutely appalling. But on the whole, the corruption was there, but it wasn't so obvious that you had to take notice of it, which one has to in some places. But there. I found Kenya at that time quite a good place to be in. I think it was a good place. I've had some pretty rough ones, and that was quite a good one.
It would have been a one-party state, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you have any particular views on this, you know, democracy in Africa? Do you think that perhaps in the West we might sort of impose a wrong system on them, and that perhaps sometimes a one-party state...
Oh, I have no doubt about that. No doubt at all. Provided that you've got a decent bloke at the top. I think we tried to... You see, what we did by introducing democracy was we emphasised tribal differences. They need not necessarily have been tribal, but it was introducing another jealousy into their existence. And I don't think it was... We tried to do it too soon. And then because... Very often the democracy collapsed almost immediately, and you've got somebody like Kwame Nkrumah or like Jomo Kenyatta. Because they were individuals, we said, well, it's not democratic, and we took a very dim view of it. And I think it was to some extent that was a pity, because Africa in particular had always had the tribal system, where the head of the tribe, whether it's a small tribe, a big tribe, or a conglomeration of tribes, they always had a head, a single head. And therefore, democracy was not by any means a natural form of government. I think gradually
You see, even dear old Botswana, who's been pretty stable right from the very beginning, I forget what his name was, but he, you see, he was a single bloke. And I think that to try and get democracy into that sort of setup, and also give the poor wretched Africans their due, we've been expecting them to do in 50 years what it's taken us 2,000 to do. And we've been surprised because they haven't done it. And I mean, look at Rome. I mean, they had emperors for God knows how long. And I think we expected too much too soon and then declined them because they hadn't come up to our expectations. And the very big, I've probably said this already somewhere along the line, but the mistake that we made in every country where we were a colony or whatever it was we did, we made one absolutely major mistake. And that is because